You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is journalist Paige Williams. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker and an educator and the author of a new book called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. This book tells the story of the trial of one Eric Prokopy, a collector and dealer of dinosaur fossils who auctioned a great big skeleton of a dinosaur that may have been illegally obtained. In following the case, Paige Williams tells us all sorts of things about fossils and about politics and about history, about dinosaur discoveries, fossil hunters, and smugglers. Paige Williams, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
You just published a major piece in New Yorker, a profile of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. That was practically a book in itself. So before we get to your dinosaurs, I want to ask you a little bit about Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So you think we should get used to Sarah Huckabee Sanders? She's here to stay.
Well, I don't know about that. She has managed to hold out in as a high-level official in the Trump administration for longer than most people, which may mean that she is exhausted and ready to go, or it may mean that she has become indispensable and would find it hard to leave. I don't know. There's been a lot of speculation over that.
But even after she leaves, you think we will someday see Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders or President Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Some say. Well, I don't know. That's how high up that would go. But quite a few people, when I was reporting that piece, mentioned her as a possible political figure, either in Arkansas or at the national level, or even within the Trump administration in a different job. One person close to the president said that this person could imagine her ascending to a cabinet position even at some point.
In this administration?
Yeah.
Well, she does have a perfect smoky eye.
I'm going to leave the smoky eye talk to others. And just say that it'll be really interesting to see what happens there and where all of this goes.
Well, The New Yorker, it's not particularly an objective magazine when it comes to the Trump administration. So how were you able to gain the trust of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the people around her?
Well, because I like to think of myself as an objective reporter. I've always been a reporter who likes to go up the middle and work the middle and lay a story out so that readers can arrive at their own thoughts and decisions about a story subject, an issue, a person, what have you. And I just kind of didn't give up. I started reporting this story months and months ago, and I believe in being really thorough and being really fair, and that might have appealed to her. I don't know. You'd have to ask her that. It's very important to be both of those things, thorough and fair, and that's something that we do at the magazine every day.
Do you think you'll write a book about Sarah Huckabee Sanders now?
I think that I will not.
You've said all there is to say about it.
I think that I won't write a book about Sanders. I think that Sanders might write her own book about herself. I mean, that's something that people close to her have wondered whether she'll do. There's a long, rich history there about Arkansas politics, and about her path to the West Wing that would, you know, that she might like to explore on her own. But for my next book, my interests lie elsewhere, outside of the White House.
I thought you were going to say she might write a book about you. That would be interesting.
I think that would probably bore everyone on Earth to death, yeah.
Well, nevertheless, no. I want to ask you, because I'm very curious about how you manage all the things that you do. So your profile of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it was long and in-depth, and yet it was as up-to-date as any newspaper article. And plus, you have a new book that, you know, must have taken considerable time, and you teach. Do you ever sleep or eat?
No, I'm glad that you pointed that out, because I don't. I just, while you were talking just then, I was drinking coffee, just to stay awake. It's been a busy time, but it's good because I like to stay busy and I get interested in a variety of things. And so for me, it's the perfect. It can feel exhausting sometimes, but it's also the perfect mix of stimulation. It's the perfect interest area. I mean, politics. You have to be paying attention during this moment that we're living in right now. And so for me, it's just every hour it seems like we're discovering something else that's happening and some new area of fascination for the American public and for journalism. And and then the book itself, you know, that fascination started years ago and it just took a while to get done because I tend to be an obsessive reporter and to probably go into way more detail than I should and to gather more information than I should, but to me that's the only way to do it. If you don't do it thoroughly and right, then what's the point in doing it? So there's very little sleep, and but I like it. That's the way, I'd have it no other way.
So you're like a method actor who writes a biography of the character they're playing, even though the viewer won't see any of those things. That's kind of how you build your story?
Yeah, I mean, the reporting should feel, you know, there's always, so what I like to tell my students and the way I've always operated as a reporter is that you're doing far more reporting than will ever show up in a magazine story or in this case, a book. And even if you don't use that material somehow informs the authority of the story or the authority of the book. So, for example, with the Sarah Huckabee Sanders profile, I spent time in Arkansas getting to know members of Sanders' family and getting to know the background that where she spent her childhood, where she grew up. She grew up in the governor's mansion in Little Rock. I spent a considerable amount of time there and used very, very little of that in the piece, as it turns out. But that reporting managed to work its way into the authority of the piece, in my opinion. So it's never wasted. It feels exhausting sometimes, but it's never... I would argue that it's never wasted.
How does it work? Does this Mr. New Yorker call you and say, we want you to write about dinosaurs, or we want you to write about Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Or do you say, I have this article I want to write? How does that work?
It's a little bit of both. I work with brilliant editors at the magazine. Daniel Zaleski is my immediate editor, and then our overall editor is David Remnick. Both of those editors have exquisite taste in stories. They're both brilliant writers in their own right, and as well as brilliant editors. And sometimes they will suggest a story idea to the staff writers, and then sometimes the staff writers will go to them or to their own individual editors with ideas. So it's a collaboration from beginning to end.
Well, your new book, it's called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. It covers so much, Paige Williams. It's got history, politics, family drama, paleontology. How did you get involved in this story?
So I've been interested in looking at that world, the world of fossil dealing and the black trade in fossils and dinosaur poaching and bone thievery for years before this case came along. I had decided that I couldn't quite find the right case to pursue as a narrative, especially as a book-length narrative. And then in the spring of 2012, this Bercoppi case came along, and it had everything that I had been looking for. You just named a lot of them with the litany you just gave. It had the history of the rise of American science. It had the geopolitics of and the diplomatic relationship between Mongolia and the United States, which factors heavily into the United States' situation with Russia and China and with North Korea. So there were lots of threads here that I found really interesting. But at the heart of it, it's about people, and it's about the people who decide to pursue the very difficult and time-consuming and dirty work of paleontology and also commercial hunting. It's an odd world. It was a world that I didn't know. I'd never heard of it. I couldn't imagine people living that life, and so I just wanted to know more. It was just once full of really crazy characters that are always, to me, irresistible. The more authentic and colorful a person, the more interested I am.
And you paint a beautiful picture of many of those characters in this book, and from various times in history. But you piqued my interest about a couple of things. I want to know, when did we first learn of the existence of dinosaurs? How did we find out there was such a thing?
Oh, gosh, now you're going to get into the details. You didn't get me into the here. I can go all day on this. But I do not know if I'm going to be able to get the dates exactly right. The first, it's all in the book, I would say. I'm sort of have book brain, a conflict between book brain and radio brain at this point, because the other day someone asked me, like, how does a fossil become a fossil? And I literally went blank, and it was like
so well in the book about how the bone is replaced by rock or it's on page 25.
Oh, well, you're a good reader. The bone is, bone is porous, so it absorbs groundwater, and whatever minerals are in the groundwater then seep into the bones, and then the bones become rock over millennia and may be colored according to what minerals got into the bones. So the dinosaur bones, for example, of the American West tend to be dark brown or sometimes even black, whereas the bones of the dinosaur bones of the Gobi Desert of Mongolia are this gorgeous color of white and are very sort of a pearly gray. So they're very distinctive in that way. But the history of dinosaur discoveries, I mean, you can mainly start in England, and God, I have a timeline for this entire book that extended over 600 pages, and it would be in that timeline, but I'm not going to be able to call these dates right off the top of my head. But basically, people found enormous bones, wondered what they were, saved them, thank goodness, to study and to sketch in the first scientific illustrations. And as the sciences of geology and paleontology, geology first and then paleontology developed, they began connecting these bones to actual animals. And it wasn't until 1841, 1842 that Sir Richard Owen in England, in London, who is responsible for giving us the Natural History Museum of London, one of the most glorious natural museum histories in the world, gave us that museum, but also gave us the term dinosauria. And coined the term dinosaur. So he had managed to connect found fossils with new forms of life. And it was around, and before then in the United States, people had been coming across similarly large bones, not in different places in the American West and even on the East Coast of New Jersey, and not knowing what they were. And also trackways, these big fossil footprints of what turned out to be dinosaurs in the western Massachusetts area, the Connecticut River Valley. And in fact, when those first trackways turned up, thanks to a farm boy named Pliny Moody, they thought that the footprints had been left by Noah's raven, the raven that was sent forth from Noah's Ark to find land. And so the townspeople decided that Noah's raven had made those footprints, but those, in fact, turned out to be dinosaurs. And the rise of American science can thank paleontology for, it was paleontology that gave us our first standing globally in science.
Well, you just kind of opened another interesting question, which is, how do creationists deal with the existence of dinosaurs?
Oh, that's not an area that I get into in this book. It's not an area that I got into in my research either. It came across, it came up from time to time, and that the idea that the Earth is X number of years old, the James Usher theory that I think was put forth in the 1600s, maybe earlier. It's all in there. I'm not going to be able to remember dates, but this was a minister in Ireland who had somehow decided that the Earth was born on October 22nd, whatever year.
4,000 years ago or something, right?
6,000, I believe, yeah. But But yeah, I don't deal with that a whole lot in this book. It came up in the research a few times, but I only dealt with it when it absolutely had to intersect with the story, and it very rarely intersected with the story.
Well, your book deals with the sort of the complicated question of who owns fossils and who has the right to sell them. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
When did it become an issue? I mean, when people first found them. I mean, if people weren't finding them, it's not like you have to. It's not like you're tripping over them. You have to go look for them, right?
Well, you do sometimes trip over them. Depending on where you are, they may just be, you know, sitting right in front of you. In the Gobi Desert of Dinosaurs, some of the nomads who live in the area. I'm sorry, in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia, some of the nomads who live in the area do basically trip over dinosaur bones in some cases, because they weather to the surface of the earth and can't help but miss them when they have surfaced in that way. It's not like, I think people have an idea that paleontologists and fossil hunters go out into a craggy area and plant a shovel and start digging, but that's not it at all. You see a lot of clues on the surface of the earth, and depending on what those landforms are that are around you, you can find different things. So what you find in Florida, for example, would be different from what you might find in South Dakota or Montana. And depending on whether there's development on top of it, whether it's overgrown with vegetation, that kind of thing. That's why badlands and deserts tend to yield fossils, because nothing's covering them up. As far as who owns them, you know, paleontology exists because the naturalists of thousands of years ago found these objects and wondered what they were, wondered what made them, wondered how they connected to life forms that no longer existed, wondered how those animals lived, how they died. And so finding a shark tooth on a mountaintop, for example, was an oddity, and it raised questions with the natural philosophers of the time. That then developed into the scientific disciplines that we know today. And until, I guess, relatively recently, questions of ownership didn't come up. It was only when land, you know, property rights and ideas of sovereignty came along that people began arguing about who has a right to pick up natural history and to keep it and to study it and to sell it. So in the United States, the federal law is such that if you find fossils on your own property or on land where you have permission to hunt, then you can keep it, you can sell it, you can do whatever you want to with it, you can start a museum with it, you can destroy it, doesn't matter, you can do whatever you want to with it. Whether it's new to science, old to science, it doesn't matter, it's just yours. You cannot do that on federal property, you cannot do that in the national parks. It is a felony to do so, and that finally was codified into a comprehensive law in 2009. In other countries, it's just flatly illegal to pick up fossils, to keep them, to pocket them, to trade in them, sell in them, display them in your house, which was the case in Mongolia. But what had happened was that a black market had cropped up around fossils and bones, and that's what leads us to the story about Prokopi.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Paige Williams. Her book is called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Paige Williams is a contributor to New Yorker magazine. One of your colleagues from The New Yorker, Amanda Petrusich, has been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, she's great.
Yes, she's terrific. And she wrote a book about obsessive 78 record collectors.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
In the course of writing her book, she became an obsessive 78 record collector. So what about you? Did you find yourself wanting to own fossils and keep them?
I did not. I found myself very happy to have one example of what I was writing about. This was the day after, I hope I'm not spoiling this for your listeners here, but the day after the story subject of the book, Eric Prokopi, got out of prison. He went to prison for this, for trying to sell this enormous tyrannosaurid dinosaur at auction in New York City in 2012. The day after he got out of prison, I went fossil hunting with him and his children. He took the children. They like to go walk along the one of the rivers in Virginia. I think it was either the York or the James. And we were walking along the riverbank, and this is the York Formation, which is a geological signature there in Virginia that produces these enormous extinct scallop remains. So it's a big scallop shell, basically. It's as big as, you know, a big hand. If you spread all your fingers out wide, it's huge. And we went looking there, and I found one that I have since framed. And then I gave my editor, Daniel Gillespie, one also, because he, you know, the book would not exist without him. He greenlit the first, he and David Remnick greenlit the first story in The New Yorker. So I gave him one, and then I gave my agent one also. So that's the only one that I have in my house that I can't imagine having a huge collection of them. I think it is. I live in New York City, and it's hard enough just to have shoes. So if I'm going to collect anything, it's going to be like cute boots.
Right, a brontosaurus skeleton would take up a lot of room in your.
Yeah, it wouldn't even fit through the front door. No.
But you can go across the park and go to the Museum of Natural History, and
sure can. Yeah, you sure can.
And have you done that? Do you, since you started your study, have you gone there and looked at all the dinosaurs?
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. And some of my most valuable sources for the book were paleontologists at the American Museum of Natural History. I mean, that museum it's just a glorious place, but it's also a deeply important scientific repository for fossils that relate to this book subject matter. I mean, the first dinosaur eggs known to science were discovered by American Museum of Natural History paleontologists and scientific teams in the 1920s under the leadership of the explorer Roy Chapman Andrews, who at that point was famous. People have sort of forgotten his name now, but he was a celebrity, if there was a celebrity back then, for his explorations in Central Asia and for bringing back just thousands and thousands of Gobi Desert bones to AMNH for study, for research. Those fossils are still at the museum. You can see a lot of them there.
Do you arrange to go there when there's not a bunch of kids running around screaming?
I like it when a lot of kids are running around screaming. So, no, I've never done like a Night at the Museum episode where I'm walking and thinking about the, you know, the creatures in the dark. But I like going when there are people there because I like seeing the reactions of people, especially the children and the grown children who have never outgrown their love for dinosaurs and their fascination with them.
Well, apparently you like people, which I don't understand, but... was it Eric that got you involved in this story? I mean, what part of this story was the New Yorker article, and how did it turn into?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the original New Yorker story dealt with the case as it played out. It started as a federal civil action in the federal courts of New York. And then, as I was reporting the magazine piece, it turned into a criminal action. They arrested Procopi at his home in Gainesville, Florida. He and his wife and two children lived in a historic home that they had remodeled, renovated from the ground up in Gainesville. And the feds showed up early one morning and knocked on the door and took him away in handcuffs. And it became a criminal action then, which brought a whole other level of tension to the story. Now he was facing it. You know, originally when he refused to surrender the dinosaur to Mongolia and to the U.S. government, when the U.S. government intervened, it was a civil action, and there was no threat of anything other than the loss of what he had invested in buying those bones and traveling to Mongolia to search for more bones. But now this was a criminal case, and he faced 17 years in prison. And so the stress level spiked considerably at that point. And the magazine story dealt with the disposition of that case, but it wasn't for a year or so after that I pitched this as a book. It wasn't until A year passed, over a year actually passed, between the publication of that magazine piece and me going to book editors and saying, I think there's something more here. So the book elaborates on the story, and I discovered a lot more in the ensuing research and in the reporting that I did after the magazine piece came out, much, much more, a year's worth of reporting more. So the book is much more in-depth than the magazine piece, and the magazine piece was pretty in-depth. So, you know, it was a deeply reported piece of work, but the book just allowed for some elaboration in certain areas.
There are no cartoons anywhere in the book, like there are in the New Yorker article.
Unfortunately, no. Unfortunately, no. Every book should have New Yorker cartoons
Shouldn't
in it,
they?
But unfortunately,
I think so.
Unfortunately, this one does not.
Did Eric Prokopy intentionally commit a crime?
I'm going to leave that to readers to read in the book and for them to decide on their own what they think happened. He pleaded guilty to smuggling charges, so that is a confession of guilt. He pleaded guilty to having misrepresented the contents of shipments on customs forms when he brought certain fossil bones into the country. But in terms of what was going on in his mind and his intention, I mean, I get into some of that, but I'd be interested to hear what readers think.
The story is kind of a sweet romantic story at first of how he and his wife meet, and they meet cute, and then they go hunting dinosaurs, and then things don't exactly work out perfectly. Were you, as a writer, were you like disappointed that things didn't go as perfectly as they might have gone if you were writing a novel?
Oh boy, wouldn't this story be different if it were fictionalized? I there would have been a lot more freedom, for one thing, to play around. But as a journalist, we stick only to facts, as you can see in that lengthy section of notes in the back. I was surprised I don't want to spoil it for your listeners, but I will say that I was surprised by a certain turn of events in the relationship there. I wasn't aware of some of that as it was going on. I'm not one of those reporters who needs a story to be tied up neatly in a cute little bow at the end. I think life is messy and choices are messy. And, in some cases people are doing the best they can under the circumstances. And, there's a tremendous amount of self-made pressure coming to bear on the situation that you can get into when you read the story, the book, involving, debt, involving finances, involving feeling cornered into making choices that are fairly unusual in the American experience. And it's not every day when a guy decides whether he's going to get into the sale of dinosaurs or not. Some of that surprised me, and I didn't know it until I started reporting the book in 2014.
So you've spent a lot of time, obviously, writing the book, and now you're doing a book chat with me and promoting your book. But as a journalist, and you wrote this Sarah Huckabee Sanders article and whatever the next thing is, you just move on to the next story, or do you feel like you'll stay in touch with the people that you've met on this journey in this book?
I've never been one of those reporters that stays deeply in touch with the people that I write about, largely because I feel like I've already, imposed enough on their time and lives. I do stay in touch with the people in this book, most of them. It's still so fresh. I mean, it just came out, a few weeks ago. So I am in touch with them fairly regularly at this point. I don't know about the future. I mean, I like to think so because I want to know what happens to them. I want to know how they do. And how they continue to sort of, you know, all of them have moved on with their lives in significant ways, and that was interesting to see and important to see, and I remain curious about what's going to happen down the road.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with New Yorker staff writer Paige Williams. Her new book is called The Dinosaur Artist: Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. Well, Paige Williams, I assume you didn't do any actual time travel, but you probably did some other kind of travel. where all did you go when you were writing this book?
Everywhere, man, everywhere. I went in this country, I don't know, a dozen states probably, primarily Florida, Virginia, Georgia, New York, and then some out west to observe some digs, some paleontological digs of on the commercial side, and then by an academic crew at a museum. I went to Mongolia. I spent the better part of August of 2015 in Mongolia reporting the book, and I went to Lyme Regis on the Jurassic coast of England, which was an amazing experience. That's where Mary Anning did all of her, the pivotal Mary Anning did all of her collection, collecting as a young poor fossil hunter in the early 1900s, more specifically. And where else did I go? Munich, to the big fossil show there, Tucson, to the huge fossil show that happens here every February, Denver, to the slightly smaller fossil show that happens every September, and all kinds of other places. The logistics were interesting, to say the least.
How do fossil collectors in Munich compare with fossil collectors in the United States? Is it the same?
Yeah, I found out the other day when a dinosaur broker who's in the book, David Herskowitz, was telling me. I asked him. He came to one of my reading that I did in Denver, and somebody asked, you know, what's the biggest country for collecting? And it surprised me. I didn't know this. He answered the question very nicely for me and said that Germany is the biggest. According to him, Germany is the biggest country for collecting, with, I think, the U.S. is second, and then elsewhere in Europe might be third. But I don't know what they're into. I don't know what specifically they collect there. Here, it runs the whole range of things, sort of depending on where you live and what you like to look for and what you might have access to. That's not to say that someone in Virginia who started out collecting giant scallop shells doesn't become interested in, you know, Cretaceous fossil bones of, you know, Texas or something. There's a lot of crossover there. So it just depends on what creature collectors are interested in, what they like to look at, because they don't collect these things to shove them in a drawer. They collect them to look at them and to talk about them and to think about them.
But there are those who collect them just because do they invest in them? I mean, they want to, you know, this bone is going to go up in price, and I'll sell it later.
You know, some people do, but I have found in all the years that I worked on this book, I found that it was less, all evidence to the contrary, it was less about money than it was about this true love for fossils and this fascination with the creatures of deep time and of the very distant past. These things are time portals. You know, if you're holding a certain fossil in your hand, you're connecting immediately and tangibly to life on Earth as it was 70 million years ago or 100 million years ago. So I think for most of these collectors, some may refer to their acquisitions as an investment object, but most don't. Most think of it as a way to stay connected to something that's much bigger and deeper and more fascinating than themselves.
Money is kind of a subtext in your book, The Dinosaur Artist. I mean, that is, there are these rich people like Nicolas Cage and Leonardo DiCaprio who, I mean, they actually own skeletons of beasts that should rightfully be in museums. And
I think that that's probably a subset of the larger collecting ecosystem. I think that there aren't that many people who have either the square footage or the disposable income to buy a big dinosaur like the one that Pacopi tried to sell in New York. The guy who did buy it is a New York real estate developer who happens to own an historic building on the Hudson River that has a cavernous, it used to be a train depot where trains could roll through that building from the river in one side, out the other side to 11th Avenue. And so in the middle, there's this cavernous arched space that he saw as a good place for this particularly large dinosaur, 8 feet tall, 24 feet long. And it was only a teenager. It wasn't even full grown when it died. So he certainly was one who had the wherewithal to buy at that level. Not everybody does. More people buy smaller things that they can put on a shelf, or, you know, display in a more discreet way in their house or in their office. And, you know, scientists wish that they wouldn't do it at all, but especially the vertebrate fossils like dinosaurs. You mentioned museums a minute ago, saying that, you know, some of those collector's items belong in a museum. They're no good to a museum if they're no good to research and science if they've been taken out of the ground in an unscientific way. They're merely a display object. They're merely something fascinating to look at and imposing and awe-inspiring to look at. They're not. They have no value scientifically if they haven't been taken out of the ground with, along with the correlating data, such as where it was found, how deep it was found, when it was found, what else was around it, like trees or plants or other creatures. So a lot of the commercial guys say, oh, well, this will be good. I'll sell it to this guy, then he'll donate it to a museum. That's not really what happens. I mean, sometimes you can donate to the collectors can donate to a private museum, and that might be fine, but there are going to be very public, which is to say tax-funded museums that hold fossils in the public trust that would take something significant that had been extracted commercially.
So the researchers would prefer that if you saw something, you rather than even touch it, you would say, hey, come over here and get this thing?
They would, yeah. The paleontologists would prefer that you tell a scientist about it. And, you know, not all discoveries get dug out. I mean, some weather away because there aren't that many paleontologists in the world, and there aren't enough to go out and collect everything that's out there. So there are some perfectly good specimens that, to the commercial guys' chagrin, turn to ash because there's no way to get them out of the ground. And if they're not allowed to get them out of the ground, then the material's just, you know, turn to nothing. But that's the system that we're working under. And there are scientists who would rather see a fossil weather away than have it dug out and sold.
In your book, you said that there's a small percentage of a chance that an animal would turn into a fossil.
It doesn't happen to everything or to everyone. It's that the right conditions have to exist. A very specific set of conditions have to exist. The creature had to have been almost captured in sediments and then go undisturbed by either weather or running water or scavengers that scatter the body parts around. It's almost like you need, in some cases, a sand dune collapses and captures the creature right where it existed in the moment that it died. I mean, fossils, animals have been found standing upright in the Gobi Desert where scientists think they suffered from a collapsed sand dune, and the soft tissues melt away, weather away, or not weather away, they just disintegrate, decompose, and what's left are the hard bits, so the bones and the teeth, and that's what you have, and that doesn't happen under other conditions, like igneous rock. You're not going to find fossils there because it's too hot. Sediments like river sediment, floods are a good way for a creature to have been preserved as a fossil. But fossils are both ubiquitous, but then the process itself is rare.
So how many complete skeletons of Tyrannosaurus rex are still out there to be found?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I think at this point, I've not checked lately, but at one point, I think there were fewer than 50 in the fossil record, which is the record of life on Earth as it's represented by the fossils known to science. There may have been more discovered by now. I don't know, but there's never been a complete. No one finds a complete dinosaur. It doesn't happen. If it has happened, I don't know about it. That usually they're found. There's a certain percentage that has to be present before science considers it largely complete or complete, and that could be 30% even. A lot of the specimens that you see mounted in natural history museums are some of the fossils are original and real. Some of them are fabricated to match the fossils that were missing. Some of them are parts from other dinosaurs that are close enough to that species to be able to blend in. So there's never been like this perfect full dinosaur, at least not a Tyrannosaurus that I know of, that's been found just perfectly intact.
I'm also so intrigued by the those that you talk about in the book, the prehistoric animals that are a variety of sizes from what we have now. That is like horses that are the size of dogs and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I want one of those. Can
yeah. I can't hook you up there. Well, you're going to have to go to Florida and see what you can find.
All right. Logic tells me that if you takes you so long to report all the things that you report, then you must be reporting something. What are you working on right now?
Oh, you know, I'm never more miserable than when I'm between assignments, and you've caught me at a moment of misery because I'm between assignments. And so I like having several things going at once, and so we're talking about that now, about what the next thing will be. And as for the next book, I have one idea. It's very, very different from the one that we're talking about today, but I want to sit with it for a bit and see if I can figure out what it actually is. And if I can figure that out, then I'll go forward with it. But stay tuned, I guess.
And you're teaching now also?
I do. I teach at Columbia and with amazing colleagues and great students. And I'm teaching a reporting class right now and writing classes later on. And it's a juggle, but it all sort of dovetails together. I feel like the teaching informs the journalism informs the teaching, obviously, and then the magazine pieces inform, books in terms of depth of research and structure and all of those craft elements. So it all works together. I think of it as a three-legged stool, and I need all three legs to make life interesting and to make it all work.
Well, this book is called The Dinosaur Artist, Obsession, Betrayal, and the Quest for Earth's Ultimate Trophy. And the author is Paige Williams. Thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, gosh, I enjoyed being here. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Before we sign off, I ran into KSCO's Michael Zwirling and Bill Graff at the county fair in Santa Cruz this year, and here's a little bit of that.
Yep.
Who are you people?
Who are you people? You don't know who these people
who
are.
Who are you people, anyhow?
Come on.
Yeah. My name is Gary Shapiro.
Gary, why didn't I? Jeez.
Monday nights at 7, the Bookshelf.
Yeah.
On
oh, see, I didn't recognize you because of your hat. And you're short.
And you usually just see me on the radio.
Yeah, and right. And didn't you lose some weight, too?
No.
No, I've always
He's always been
slender.
Nice and thin. Cool. By the way, I've told you this before. I love your program.
I like hearing it again.
I do. I love that program.
And you told me, and you're the guest author's favorite interviewer, because you actually read every word.
I read the book.
Yeah. You know what? As somebody who also interviews people, that makes a big difference. If you know what you're talking about when you ask the questions, the people who get asked the questions understand that.
It like makes it a big difference.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
Well, I'm proud to be on KSCO. So
thank
good
you.
To see you guys out here at the fair.
You have added the needed touch of class to KSCO. It was desperately needed.
It was my pleasure. You can also hear me Wednesday morning. It's Wednesday at 8:15.
Yes.
We'll be doing book reviews with Rosemary.
So yeah.
Is that new? Is that just starting?
Yeah.
How cool. Yeah. Wow, that's great.
Did I mention From the Bookshelf is Monday nights at 7?
You did.
Oh,
it's a wonderful show.